have to be willing and wanting redemption. And so that's the first hurdle for Michael, is to get to that point. See, he's when we start this season, he's in on the negative side of the spectrum of life. He just wants to not exist.
Yeah,
that's what he wants. He doesn't want to exist. He wants his physical body to catch up with the deadness of his emotional life and his intellectual life. It's gone. Yeah. He's gone. Yeah. So he just wants that. So he's in that negative space, and he has to get to neutral to be able to recognize, oh, can I be redeemed? Is there redemption? So he's not there yet. It has to get to that neutral spot. And the power of forgiveness, which is something I think our society is lacking. I think it is a beautiful human strength for someone to recognize fault, recognize mistakes, and ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's not a weakness. It is equally empowering for the wounded person to grant forgiveness, to let it go, and to accept that this person has asked and has changed.
Hey, everybody, that is the amazing Bryan Cranston. I'm so excited to have him on the show a second time. We are talking about his character, Michael Desiato, in the Showtime series, Your Honor, which just started its second season. And I will tell you that, I mean, it's such a treat to have Bryan on, because he's so interesting and so connected to the human condition, makes choices in characters and storytelling that are really interesting and reflect who we are as human beings, flawed in many different ways. And here specifically, he was talking about his character falling from grace and seeking redemption and forgiveness. And it's just a really interesting conversation. He's really fun and funny in it too. And it's a real treat for me to have him on again. And this is a really special episode. So please share it with your friends, send it around, send the link around. I want everybody to hear this interview. It's really an honor, no pun intended, to have him on the show again and talk to a real pure artist who's at the top of his game. All right, enjoy this conversation. It's Bryan Cranston. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm so excited to have as a returning guest. I have no idea why he came back. My friend, I can call him my friend, and my fashion partner, black t-shirt, Emmy, Tony Award winner, Golden Globe winner, Oscar nominee, great Bryan Cranston, who has started his second season starring in Your Honor on Showtime, which is airing Sundays at 9 p.m. And it is so fantastic to have you back. And this show is so freaking good. It's crazy.
Congrats. Oh, good. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how excited I am to talk about this with you, because the work you do is so deep and layered and meaningful, and you tap into these sort of dark places in a good way that you don't often see. And to me, and this is hard for me because I have a son, not quite the age that your character's son is when he passes, and Rocco, but you know, it's sometimes hard, which means what you're doing is good, right? Because it's touching me in a real place. But to me, the big themes here are, you know, loss, denial, forgiveness, redemption. And to me, denial especially, but within the idea of self-denial, which I think in some ways is more destructive and powerful than denial to those out around you, right? Because your character in the first year says to the Charlie, the mayor, I got this. And you could just see like he doesn't have it. And I just thought that was so powerful. And I wanted to explore that with you a little bit, because obviously that was one of the intentions of the show and how you guys are addressing that.
It's, you know, what you responded to is what I think the Showtime audiences responded to as well. And certainly what made me want to do this series was that initial concept of what would you do to save the life of your child? And I would do anything.
Yeah.
And so the follow-up question is, would you knowingly become a criminal if you felt that would protect your child? I would.
Yeah.
And then it's, and then you go one layer deep, and this is where my character, Michael Desiato, found himself in peeling back the onion of this is, okay, well, what if an innocent person was hurt or killed in what you were doing as a result of what you're doing? Then all of a sudden you give pause, but my character wasn't able and wasn't given the luxury of time to think about what are the ramifications of this initial decision. It's something that every person would make. And then all of a sudden the downward spiral happens and you're trying to hold on to something. And that's what makes great television is that, oh, I get it. I see how he got himself into that position.
Well, because when you're in when you're at the parking lot of the police station, it's a nanosecond. You take one more step and he sees your kid, the kid's probably dead, or you are, or both. And so you can't, you're obviously a brilliant guy, you're a judge, you have a legal mind, but you can't process all of that. You just, and now you're down this slippery slope. And, you know, you described, I think the term you used in an interview I read is animalistic, that he's animalistic in a way in terms of his approach. And then it harkened back to Walter White for me and how there are similarities in the two characters. Sort of, they've started to convince themselves that there's justification to what they have to do. But then there's, and if you refer to this, Michael's character's ripple effects to the person's, your characters, both Walter White and Michael. And is there something about you subconsciously, you seem to gravitate to these people who have these very deep moral dilemmas, or are you just a drug dealer and a murderer and that's
I am attracted to flawed human beings.
Yeah.
Because I think we all are.
Yeah.
And part of the empathy that an audience will extend to a character is if they see the character trying to be better.
Oh yeah.
If a person that's why the old 1980s and the TV shows or whatever, where you're a bad guy, black hat, or you're a good guy, white hat. You know, the good guys always make the right decisions. They're always good. And the bad guys are always bad.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
not real. And that's not the way life is. There are moments when you feel that you are your better angel. And then there are other times when you went, oh my God, what have I done? That's not me. What have I done? I don't believe I did that. And, you know, you have to find redemption somehow. And so when a character is presented flawed, but with aspirations of improvement, audience can go, I understand you. I know you. I'll follow you.
Well, you do such a great job in the writing and in the acting of just seeing on your face moment to moment this, all of this conflict that in season one and then carries over to season two. And what really struck me about season one is your fall from great, anybody that breaks the law, which your character does in a couple of instances, is a fall from grace because it's the law. But it's a greater fall from grace for you, who's a judge, whose job is to uphold the law and is sort of one of the pillars of legal pillars of society. And as a former lawyer myself, you know, they really struck home. And that to me just raised the stakes even more and had to make it juicy, more juicy for you and fed you more as an actor in terms of what you could do with the character, I would imagine.
Especially because the literal description of a judge is to judge right from wrong. And all of a sudden he crossed that line himself. And when he told that initial lie to protect his son, oh, he then realized, oh, I have to tell more lies to cover up the first lie. And then I have to, which begats more lies. And pretty soon you become a liar. Yeah. And that's what he became. He lost his sense of purpose and principle and integrity. And he lost his son's life, his wife's life, his job. He lost his friends, his standing in the community. And so that's where season two picks up And why I'm excited about it is because Showtime was courageous enough to trust us when I said, I want to explore the authenticity of despair and grief. God forbid this happen to people, and it does, of course. What's the reality of that? The reality is, to me, in my research on it, of going into the five stages of grief and loss, is it never leaves you. It will always be with you. You will wear the emotional and sometimes physical scars of that tragedy, of that loss. And despite that, you have to find a way to carve out really what is a new life for you. You have no idea what to expect of that new life, as my character in season two has no idea what's in store for him.
Right.
And he's stepping through life in kind of a haze. He doesn't know. And why I have all that hair is because he doesn't care. Grooming? What does grooming mean to me? What does eating mean to me? What does following a law or instructions, what does that mean to me? I don't, you know, it's a new world. And so Michael Desiato is struggling through this, but I promise you, and the viewers watching it, Paul, it is not maudlin. It doesn't stay in this depressed state. It really moves, and the characters are around and doing other things, and there's action and intrigue, and it's really a good season.
Well, it's funny, you know, because that was one of the things I wanted to ask you is the challenge of not having this just live in the morbid, right? Like, you know, it's as dark as it gets. People are losing their children. A man is lost. He's got to live with grief. I mean, Hope Davis is, I don't want to give this away, but she's in, Gina is in the therapy session with the group. Boy, is she. And
yeah.
she just says, I'll just paraphrase, you'll know what I'm talking about. I said, I know there's five stages, but I'm in this stage and this is where I want to be. And I totally get that, because the fifth stage is supposed to be acceptance. But I think what you were just saying, even with acceptance, you still have this thing on your shoulder that you're going to have to live with and somehow get up and walk through life. And I know what that's like. There's some days, some stuff didn't happen, could work out for me or whatever, but you just feel so down. It's like, how am I going to get up and take a shower and go get a coffee outside? Like, just put one foot in front of the other. And you could feel that with him. But in the first episode of the new season, you see him, I think you used this term in talking about this with somebody else, he's starting to spiral up as opposed, because he was spiraling down.
Yeah.
In that first...
It was by design. I wanted to, this season was really mapped out by Peter Moffat, our showrunner from the first season, and me. The two of us got together and we said, well, where would he be? What would his life be like? And we both realized that we put the audience through a lot of anxiety and trauma and ending in tragedy. And it was a very appropriate ending of season one. But we didn't want to put the audience through that much. We wanted to give them a sense of hope. So this season, believe it or not, actually does have an upward spiral, and we'll leave with a sense of hope. Are all the answers provided? No, that's not life either. That's not fair. But we get a sense, we as an audience, you'll get a sense of where this man is going in his life and where other characters are going. And without tying it in a nice, neat little bow, you'll make presumptions of where characters will end up.
Yeah. Well, you know, this idea of season two being about redemption, it really struck me. But it was, to me, I started to think, okay, internally, this is a very principled guy. You know, you know, not because he's a judge, but this is just a fundamentally good person, right? So he goes and he does these bad things, justified in his mind. Now he's trying to get, maybe whether he even knows this consciously in the beginning of season two, he's on a path to redemption. Maybe this is me and I have Catholic guilt. I don't know. But like, if you're that principled, can you allow yourself to be truly redeemed because you know how far you've fallen, right? Like all of this stuff we're talking about has to emanate from inside first, right? And I'm just curious, can he do that? Have you thought about that? Have you guys talked about that in drawing up the arc for season two?
Well, first, like the stages of loss or grief, you have to be willing and wanting redemption. Mm. And so that's the first hurdle for Michael, is to get to that point. See, he's when we start this season, he's in on the negative side of the spectrum of life. He just wants to not exist.
Yeah,
that's what he wants. He doesn't want to exist. He wants his physical body to catch up with the deadness of his emotional life and his intellectual life. It's gone. Yeah. He's gone. Yeah. So he just wants that. So he's in that negative space. And he has to get to neutral to be able to recognize, oh, can I be redeemed? Is there redemption? So he's not there yet. It has to get to that neutral spot. And the power of forgiveness, which is something I think our society is lacking. I think it is a beautiful human strength for someone to recognize fault, recognize mistakes, and ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's not a weakness. It is equally empowering for the wounded person to grant forgiveness, to let it go, and to accept that this person has asked and has changed and has contrite for the issues that have been between. So it's equally needed to have someone ask for forgiveness. It needs to be met halfway to accept that forgiveness and to grant it.
You know, it's interesting because I just did a commentary about the Damar Hamlin and, you know, the outpouring. And it really struck me that it really felt like we're so divisive, bad economic news, we're in our silos. It felt like everybody did those things for him as much for him as they did for themselves. I think we all needed to just like drop everything and go, you know what? I don't care if you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm a this, you're that, I'm rich, you're poor, I'm Jewish, you're black. Can we just go help this guy? Cause it's the right thing to do and it will all make us feel a little bit better. And I think that theme of that sort of idea that we kind of all, I mean, this clearly resonates with me in terms of we've all been down this road in some way, shape, or form, done something we're ashamed of, have to deal with it. And then how do we get other people to accept us again? And I think it's really, really powerful. I mean, obviously, your character's done some intense stuff, but why do you think it's hard for us to forgive in society? Is it because of the political hostility and all some of that? Or is it why have we seemed to have gotten to that point? Because I agree with you.
I think it's largely if people are led by their ego, it gets them in trouble. They double down on something or are belligerent. They hold fast to a dogmatic belief. Like, you know, what used to be like, show, you know, men don't cry, show you're a man, be a man. And it's like, what does all that mean? And young boys for generations are growing up thinking, oh my God, I'm not a man. I cried. I just cried. And it's like, oh, please, God, let humans be humans and let us experience itself and life to its fullest. And part of that is recognize if you ever want to get along with other people, you have to come to terms with realizing that at times you make mistakes. Mm. You fuck up.
Yeah.
And when you do, it may take a little time, step back, think, I've done it. I've done something I really don't believe in. That really is not how I truly feel. I've hurt someone, I've damaged someone with what I've said or what I've done, and I need to make amends.
Well, I gotta,
a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
Doing it, and they'll push away, and that person becomes an island emotionally. They wall themselves off from the rest of people who, for that point on, they may not get close to anybody.
Yeah, I mean, you at the at episode one of the second season, and when you see you crawl out of that bed, you just, I'm like, was that Howard Hughes in Vegas? Like, it was just, but it's such a great choice because you immediately get, without saying a word or even just seeing your face in the shadows, you know, it's you. It's like, this guy's given up. He's just given up. And then that scene of being force fed, so powerful. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
my throat still hurts watching it. So you guys did a really, really good job. I was like, how the hell did he do it? Like, that was amazing. I mean, I know it's, you know, whatever, but
I watched some videos of people being force fed, and you know, observed the sounds and the movement of the twitches and the convulsions that happened, and trying to get it out of the throat or trying to deal with the discomfort, and it was very helpful. But that was our showrunner, Joey Hartstone, and his writing staff came up with that idea. And it was brilliant to be able to, and to start off with that, it really starts with a bang. It's like, here, this poor bastard.
Did you lose some weight to look that amazing?
Oh yeah. I
lost. Don't get me wrong. You still look, you still got the body.
No, I've gained a lot of it. I just came out of the holidays, man. I just gained a lot. And I had a vacation in Hawaii, so it was like, nice. Oh my God. So
thank God. Nobody had to force feed you. But you know, it's funny because you talked about the idea of redemption, and you know, you said you wanted to explore that in an honest way, to be, were we able to see that there can be a reconstruction of a human being if that person followed your phrase, certain human protocols. And I know what protocols mean, but in that context. So what does that mean for Michael in season two? Like, what do you mean by protocols that one would have to follow to kind of reconstruct their life in some way?
There are several little things that we included in it. For example, he lived for a year under rules where he was being force-fed a couple times in prison because the state of Louisiana, like many states, won't allow a person to kill themselves. They don't want that on their records. And so this is what the law is. But also, when he gets out, he's unfamiliar. He shut down the circuits of his life once his son was murdered. He didn't care. He doesn't observe laws, rules, social mores. He bathes when they push him into the shower, and I guess they force him to clean. What's the point? He lets his hair go, whatever. He doesn't want to eat, so he loses a tremendous amount of weight. He walks around in a circle in the prison yard. It's a different world, a different life for him. And even so,
but you know where it told me that he still had a little hope? He stops in the doorway where there's sun coming in, and he just takes the sun in for about 30 seconds. And that kind of told me that he kind of still wants to live.
Well, I'm glad you picked that out, because I added that to the scene on the day. When I saw that shaft of light coming through, I said, oh, I want to do this moment. And from the very beginning, we felt that Michael would be depleted of any interest in showing human exchange. And that's what I meant by the protocols, the life's protocols, how social laws, legal laws, things that you abide by. And one of those, so I said, slowly, incrementally, over the course of the season, he starts experiencing little moments of humanity. Like catching a ray of sun is a little moment of humanity. Yeah. He couldn't articulate it, but I wanted the audience to feel it, just to get a sense like there's something that Michael is not aware of that's so deep. Yeah. He can't, it's not in his conscious thoughts. Another time is in episode two, you'll see, I'll even say this, that I set up a thing where I wanted him, he's walking on the street and he crosses the street to go to a house and a car is in the street and he's startled by the car and it goes by and he wasn't aware of it. And he realized, oh, I'm out of touch with the laws of the world and red light, green light, what is acceptable? And he feels vulnerable to that. He almost has to relearn those things like a child would learn those.
It's funny, when you were talking about when he walking on the street and the way he looked and that car happens, I saw the episode. I said, it felt like a guy who was like stranded on an island for 3 years and then just got dropped back into New Orleans and like has to figure it all out again.
Yeah.
He just really read that way. And the choice, I was interested about, you can stay in the guest room, but you're sleeping in the pantry.
Right. Well, I think you're getting into episode two right now. Oh, so,
never mind.
You son of a bitch. You.
Did I say sleeping? You went into the pantry to get some. That's what I meant. So did you? So now we know, because episode one is aired, that you have a grandson.
Yes. Well, as it turns out, Michael doesn't know that. Michael still doesn't know that at the end of episode one. It's a little nugget for the audience to have. It's always good to have the awareness what the audience knows and what they should know at any given time. And it's like you can be slightly ahead to where the audience doesn't quite know yet what's going on, but you can't be too far ahead because then they get lost and go, wait, what's going on? I'm confused. What's all this? So you have to fluctuate between just being slightly ahead of them, or in this case, with the awareness of a grandchild, slightly below. My character, it doesn't know as much as the audience knows right now. Right. And so there's joy in getting that character and seeing that character discover that.
Yeah, and that's the thing that you love when you're watching it. It's like how would you react? Is he going to reject it? Is he going to accept it? It's like, it's so good because there's so many emotions that you put us through simultaneously as the viewer, like you can't take your eyes off it and it all feels so real. And the scenes with you and Charlie, the mayor, are just so heartfelt because you could see the anguish on your face. And I'm not giving anything away here because people have seen the show. It's just, he's your really only friend in the world. And yet there's things going on and things you've put him through. And
it's complicated.
I feel for you and I'm kind of mad at you at the same time because he's a good guy. And it's like, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah. That's what makes a good narrative storytelling is make it complicated, make it difficult. Put characters into an untenable corner and they have to then figure out how do I get out of this and what do I do? That's a great way to create it. And the writers did a great job this year.
As they're writing this series, are the characters talking to you all? In other words, are you finding new layers of relationships that you with new layers within a relationship that your character has with different various other characters, because you can't plan everything out, obviously. You know, we've both written, we've been in rooms, blah blah blah. How has that process worked for you all?
Often the characters will speak to you, and then you have discussions with your head writer, and you know, you figure out where it is exactly. I know all of the actors, every single actor on our show had discussions with Joey Hartstone, our showrunner, and giving him their opinion. And we'd see changes come because he's listening to what the actor is telling him. And it's a sign of maturity for a writer to listen, because that actor has taken ownership of that character. And they're telling you, I know this character now better than you do. Yeah. And I'm saying, this is what it should be like. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, my character, Michael, didn't want to exist. So there were some conversations early on and some ideas early on that maybe my character gets into a bar fight, maybe, you know, he's drinking too much, maybe he's just, and it's like, no, that's not where the character is. He doesn't want to exist. He's not angry. He's not resentful. He's not wanting to get back and vengeful at anything. He's done.
He's atrophied. He's just
He's emotionally atrophied. And how do you resuscitate that? Yeah. Is there life from someone who doesn't want life? Yeah. It's a very compelling and interesting exploration.
Yeah, and it is. And you do start to feel it sort of moving up. I know we're going to jump in a minute, but two things. I love that Jimmy Baxter is not a typical, hey, I mobster guy. And I know, because I grew up in Rhode Island, the home of the New England crime family, and my cousin, he runs numbers. He's a numbers runner. And they're definitely, he's not a dems and these and those kind of guy. And I love that. Although you feel it, you feel that mobster. He's such a good actor.
Michael Stuhlbarg, yeah.
Yeah. And then Rosie Perez was, when you first see Rosie, every time you see Rosie, you get this look like, oh, her again. I'm not going to give it away, but there's one scene, I think in episode 2 or 3, where you're sitting somewhere and you just like, you could just see it on your face. Like, I'm going to fucking kill her. So good.
I can only have that experience with a gifted actor, and Rosie Perez is just that. She came in and just grabbed a hold of that character. Yeah. And, you know, bam, we hit loggerheads right away in a good way, in a strong way as characters. And it was a great experience working with her.
Real quick before we jump, she said to you in the beginning, I can't do this. I think she said, and like in terms of the role or whatever, which why did she feel that way?
The development of this character that she plays, Olivia, a deputy district attorney, came up late. And we realized what we wanted in an actor, what we needed in an actor to be able to fulfill this commanding role. Mm. And so we were scurrying around, and Rosie's name came up, and I went, that's it. And I said, I know her. Let me call her. So they sent the script. They sent the offer. And then we have a very good mutual friend of ours. And she said, I don't know. And our mutual friend, Ramon Rodriguez, said, no, you should really pay attention. You should do this. So with his approval, you know, and acceptance, I called her and I said, Rosie, I know. She goes, it's too late. There's no time to work. I mean, it was literally offer a Friday, get on a plane Saturday.
Really?
Do the wardrobe fitting on Sunday, and then you're working Monday. And so she was nervous, and she will tell you herself, so I'm not speaking out of turn. She was really, really nervous, and I totally get that. She was thrown at her, but those first scenes were when we're in the prison area together, and she's talking to me, and she says, tells me who she is and what she wants, and you're going to help me, and all those commanding assurances. And as soon as we were done, she goes, oh God, you know, I'm so nervous. And I go, you'd never know it. And that's why she's such a good actor, is because you don't know it. And that's acting. You put the facade over.
Yeah.
But you wear the cloak and you perform something else, and the audience doesn't see what's behind that.
And I love the choice she made too, of like, to be playful with you. You're going to do this, and then you're going to do this, almost like you're a child, as opposed to like, look, you don't get it. See, We're going to do this and we're going to do that, which is like you've seen, like you said, go back to the 80s. It's so fun. I like, she just looks, she pulls her glasses down and looks at you like there's just always a like a thing with you. It. There's two things going on at least between the two of you. It's your characters. It's great.
My character, my being in character with her, she keeps coming up to me. She keeps engaging me. And I tell, just get away from me. I don't want to have anything to do with you. You know, but she won't. She's relentless.
Yeah. Well, listen, I know you weren't going to do a season two. I'm so glad you did do a season two. And I thought it was interesting, by the way, just as we finish up here, that you described the way season one ended as lovely and tidy, which was like, but then you wanted to really explore this next layer, and we're really glad you did. It's really terrific, and I can't wait to see the rest of this season. And you just do amazing work that really speaks to the human condition, and I think that's a very important thing that art should do. So
thank you,
congratulations. Paul. Yeah, so great to have you on, and see you in New York, I hope, or LA. Bryan Cranston, everybody.
There you go. How great is Bryan Cranston? Could talk to him all day. He's like a acting teacher and a therapist and a best friend all rolled into one. He's such a great guy. I hope you enjoyed it. Please send it around. Tell your friends about it. It's a really special interview. I'm really proud of it. And we will see you guys next week.